today on Against the Grain. What is it about the city of Jerusalem and what Israel has done to it that makes Donald Trump's promise to move the U.S. embassy there so inflammatory? And why did Frida Berrigan, whose activist parents were in and out of prison, why did she become so involved in efforts to close Guantanamo? I'm CS. You'll hear from the director of the Civic Coalition for Palestinian Rights in Jerusalem, as well as the daughter of Philip Berrigan, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. During his campaign, Donald Trump promised to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He also vowed to, quote, load up the military detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. Today we bring you two activists, one who understands firsthand the controversy surrounding Israel's claims on Jerusalem, and another who has firsthand knowledge of what detention does to those in prison and to their families. Later this hour, you'll hear from Frida Berrigan, an activist and writer who helped found Witness Against Torture, a nonviolent direct action group dedicated to ending torture and detention at Guantanamo Bay. She is the daughter of two prominent peace activists, the late Philip Berrigan and Elizabeth McAllister. We begin with Zakaria Odeh, who executive directs the Civic Coalition for Palestinian Rights in Jerusalem. Odeh gave a talk last June in Chicago about what the Israeli state has done in and to East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem, which Palestinians view as the capital of their future state, was captured by Israel from Jordan in 1967. The official Israeli position is that the entire city of Jerusalem is Israel's eternal, undivided capital. Although Israel annexed East Jerusalem, it is still considered occupied territory by most of the world. Here's Zakaria Odeh speaking in Chicago on June 6th of last year.
As you might know, that based on the partition plan before 1948, according to the partition plan, it was decided that East and West Jerusalem should be kept under international United Nations umbrella. So there was no division for Jerusalem. Until now, in the United Nations, they deal with Jerusalem as one city. There is no East and West. But this is, has became talking about East Jerusalem later through the various resolution and after the establishment of the Israeli state. But this partition plan, as you know, it was rejected by the Arabs because it didn't fulfill the right of the Palestinians. So after the clashes between the militia, Zionist militia, and the Arabs who were trying to resist the taking over occupation of Palestine, nearly 80,000 Palestinians were forced to leave West Jerusalem to East Jerusalem and to the rest of the West Bank. 38 villages were completely destroyed in the area of Jerusalem. So that was in 1948. You know, after 1967, as you know, the rest, the West Bank and Gaza were occupied, including East Jerusalem. So all Jerusalem became under the Israeli occupation. And always we say the problem in Jerusalem is not really the occupation, neither even in the occupied territories. You know, because what we are facing a colonial apartheid settler regime in Palestine. But what's more worse for Jerusalem is the annexation. 2 weeks after the occupation of East Jerusalem, Israel expanded the border of East Jerusalem, where the city of East Jerusalem, where it annexed 70 square kilometers from the land of the West Bank into the Israeli municipality border of Jerusalem. So East Jerusalem became under, as a result of the annexation, it became under the Israeli jurisdiction, the people and the property. And that's what makes it different than the rest of the West Bank and Gaza, which has been under the military military rule or military occupation. Of course, since the occupation of Jerusalem, Israel start implementing policies which always aim to control and grab more land of the Palestinians and trying to force the Palestinians to leave the city of occupied East Jerusalem. In addition to the annexation, which took place just 2 weeks after the occupation, in 1980, Israel, the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, they passed a law where they call it the basic law. It's not a constitution, but it has the power of the constitution. According to this law, they declare East and West Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. So the annexation and the declaration that East and West Jerusalem is the capital of Israel were the legal framework and the main legal framework that Israel has established after 1967. And all the policies that has been implemented since then, now 49 years of occupation, is all in order to achieve that East Jerusalem with West Jerusalem is the capital of the Israeli state. In spite of that, the international community, even the United States, till now, officially, they consider occupied East Jerusalem is an occupied city and it's part of the occupied territories, and they are not accepting that it is part of Israel. Of course, this annexation as well, it deprived the Palestinian from the protection which Geneva Convention gave us as people under occupation. You know, according to the Geneva Convention, people under occupation should be protected. But because Israel didn't acknowledge and hasn't been acknowledging that till now, so that deprived the Palestinian from the right for protection again according to the Geneva Convention. You know, Israel, since its occupation of East Jerusalem, they always try to strengthen its sovereignty over Jerusalem and trying to create a Jewish majority in the city of occupied East Jerusalem. So the demographic issue is one of the main concern that always the different Israeli governments, Israeli parties or leadership, they try to achieve. So always in their mind that Palestinians should be a small minority. In 73, there was a Gefna committee which recommended that Palestinians in Jerusalem shouldn't be more than 22% of all the population of Jerusalem, East and West. In 2020, according to the main and major Israeli master plan, they call it 2020, which how they envision Jerusalem, they talk about 30% Palestinian and 70% Israeli Jewish. So always they try to stress the issue of the demographic issue. They always try to stress that always Jerusalem, united, the capital of Israel, should be majority Jewish population. That was stated very clearly even in the Israeli master plan, urban plan in 2020. You know, they say in that introduction, East and West united with a Jewish majority, the capital of the Jewish state and the center of all the Jews all over the world. That's how the Zionist leadership, it's how the Israeli leadership, how they envision Jerusalem. That's how they see Jerusalem in the long run. So in order to achieve that, the Israeli government and institution, they start establishing various laws to take over lands. So always we say the Israeli institutions are really very creative in this regard. So one of the main laws that they use to take over land is confiscation land for public purposes. This is one of the main laws for public, like governmental buildings or for services or anything for the interest of the people or the public. But if you look at on the ground, they hardly really did anything for the purpose of the public. The second law that they used is absentee property law. You know, this law was established in 1950, and most of the land within what's called now Israel in 1948 or in the green area, it was grabbed under this law, the absentee property law. I think you are aware of this law. This law, if any Palestinian during the war in 48 or during the war in 1967, if she or he were outside the country, so they consider absentee. So the property, whether land or houses or whatever it is, it goes to the government of Israel. So Israel, after 67, they start implementing this law in order to take over the property in occupied East Jerusalem. The other law or the other procedure, which is green area, you know, they have a system where they declare some area as a green area. Usually this green area is supposed to be like parks, gardens. So a lot of the land, nearly 22% of the land of occupied East Jerusalem is confiscated or taken over under this law as a green area. If you go in all East Jerusalem, you will not see any park or any garden for the Palestinians in East Jerusalem. So nowadays, nearly 87% of all the land of the occupied East Jerusalem is under the complete control and use of the Israeli government. Only 13% of all the land in occupied East Jerusalem is left for the use of the Palestinians, for housing, for commercial, for any public use for the Palestinian in East Jerusalem. So all what we have, the only space that is left for us is only 13% of all the land of occupied East Jerusalem. Of course, land and land control is connected with building settlements. All of us, we hear about building settlements. In East Jerusalem, in the city of East Jerusalem, there are now 16 settlements, nearly 215,000 Jewish settlers. They live in East Jerusalem, in the part which was occupied in 1967. 45% of all the population of occupied East Jerusalem are Jewish settlers. You know, now Israel, they don't talk about East Jerusalem. What they talk about Greater Jerusalem. You know, Netanyahu, he talked many times about what we are achieving. We are achieving Greater Jerusalem. Greater Jerusalem, for the Israeli leadership, its border in the south, it reached Hebron, Gosh Atzion, settlement block. If somebody, if any of you is aware of Gosh Atzion, I think Don knows very well Gosh Atzion. So it is in the border of Hebron, between Bethlehem and Hebron, in the east, in the border of Jericho and the Jordan Valley, and in the north, in the border of Ramallah. So for them, this is Jerusalem. This is what they call the Greater Jerusalem. They try to connect the settlements into West Jerusalem, and they try to get rid or to take out the Palestinian neighborhood outside the border of the city of Jerusalem. You know, now with the Jerusalem now is completely surrounded by the wall, the separation wall, which was established after 2005, and the military checkpoint, which were established in 1993. So now Jerusalem is like a big prison. It's closed completely. People can go in and out from three or four gates or entrances. By constructing the wall, five Palestinian Jerusalemite neighborhood became outside the wall. Nearly 90,000 Palestinians, they live outside the separation wall, outside the checkpoint. What does that mean? In the long run, that these people will lose their right to be part of the city of Jerusalem. So this is part of the policy that they are implementing in order to force the people to leave the city and to create a majority of Jewish Israelis.
That's Zakaria Odeh giving a talk last June. Odeh is executive director of the Civic Coalition for Palestinian Rights in Jerusalem and also president of the Defense for Children International Palestine. This is Against the Grain. Let's return now to more of Odeh's talk delivered at Hyde Park Union Church in Chicago.
Land control, building settlement as well, is connected with the Israeli discriminatory urban planning policy. You know, the Israeli plans, the master plans that they always try to draft for Jerusalem, they never took in consideration that there is a Palestinians who live in Jerusalem. Yani there are some engineers, experts, who study the master plan 2020. They said that the planners, the Israeli planners, when they put the plan, they didn't take in any consideration that there are Palestinian peoples in this area. So the main objective of the Israeli planning system is how to increase the Jewish settlers, how to increase the Jewish settlement in occupied East Jerusalem, and how to create a majority of Jews vis-a-vis a small minority of Palestinian Arabs. So this is the main theme of any Israeli planning policy or any urban planning policy in the area of Jerusalem. Of course, this short of land creates a housing problem. You know, according to the planner, there is a shortage or there is a need for 40,000 housing units for the Palestinian who lives in Jerusalem. So housing is really one of the main challenges or one of the main problems that Palestinians are facing in occupied Jerusalem or in the city of Jerusalem. The shortage of land, there is only 25% of the land of East Jerusalem has a master plan. And you know, if there is no master plan, you can't apply for building permit. You can't build a house. In addition to that, Israel, they put a lot of restriction on obtaining building permits. You know, if any Palestinian wants to obtain a building permit, this is a very complicated, very difficult process. Usually, people denied the right for obtaining a building permit. Just to give you an example, sometimes it takes 5 to 10 years to get a license or a permission to build a house. To build an apartment or a house of only 100 square meter, Palestinian in East Jerusalem has to pay average $35,000. Just the fees for getting a permission, even before you start building a house. And you know, they put another condition that we have to provide a document that we own the land in the name of the individual who or he, she, who are trying to build a house. And you know, in Palestine, most of the land is collective ownership from the Ottoman, then the British, then the Jordanian, then the Israelis. So they put a lot of restriction in order to prevent Palestinian from obtaining building permits. Because people, they can't build houses, they don't have permission. Israel always denying them. You know, always the municipality of Jerusalem, the Israeli municipality, is the municipality which is in charge of these things. So people, Palestinians in East Jerusalem, they're growing up. They are increasing. So people, they have no choice, but they build without a permission. In East Jerusalem, there are 20,000 apartments or houses that were built without a permission, 20,000. Nearly 85,000, one-third of the Palestinians in Jerusalem, they live in homes without a permission. You know, according to the Israeli law, if you build without a permission, the house must be demolished. That's why if you hear every day, there are 5, 6, 7 houses that are demolished by the municipality of Jerusalem in the city of Jerusalem. In spite of all the policies, in spite that Israel always try to force the people to leave the city and to decrease the number of the Palestinians, you know, now Palestinians in Jerusalem as a whole, we are nearly 39% of all the population of Jerusalem. 39. And this is driving the Israeli leaders and institutions mad, crazy, because with all what they do, with all the housing, land confiscation, the planning, restriction on buildings, but the number of the people are increasing rather decreasing. So we are nearly 39 of all the population of all Jerusalem, east and west. So land confiscation and planning is really one of the main challenges that are facing Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem. The other main challenge is legal status or residency right for the Palestinians in East Jerusalem. You know, Israel, when they occupied East Jerusalem, They thought, okay, what kind of legal status are we giving these Palestinians? So they decide that we are permanent residents. So we are like anybody, any foreigner, he or she, they come, they stay for some time, they become residents. So they consider us as residents according to the 1952 law, which is the entry law into Israel. This law was established in 1950 to control the illegal immigration into Israel. So Israel, after 67, they start implementing this law on Palestinians who lives in the occupied East Jerusalem. According to this law, they have the right to revoke our residency. Our residency, it's an ID, which is temporary ID. We have to renew it every 10 years. If we don't renew it, we lose our residency. So the Israeli Minister of Interior, who has the mandate to revoke our residency, when they can do that? For example, if any Palestinians live outside the city of Jerusalem more than 6 years, he or she, they lose their residency. Even if they come in summer, every summer, like let's assume a student study in the United States. In summer, he or she doesn't have courses, they go back to Jerusalem. Even if you go every year, every summer, and stay in Jerusalem, and you do that 6 years, year after year, you lose your residency. If anybody gets a residency or citizenship from any other country, and if somebody gets a green card or a citizenship in the US or Europe, anybody, he or she, they lose their residency to stay in Jerusalem. They have as well, they created a law which they call it the Center of Life Law, where each Palestinians, they have to prove always, all the time, that their life, their center of life is in East Jerusalem. What does that mean? People have to be, their work, their job or their work should be in East Jerusalem, and their accommodation or their residence in East Jerusalem. If anybody goes and live in Ramallah or Bethlehem, which I think a lot of you knows, it's 15 minutes from Jerusalem. And if you leave the border of the Israeli municipality for Jerusalem, if you live in the district of Jerusalem, outside the municipality border, you lose your residency. You know, there is no land, there is a shortage of houses, apartments, renting is very expensive. The minimum for any apartment to rent in East Jerusalem, it needs like $1,000 a month. So people, usually they try to go and live in Ramallah or Bethlehem because it's cheaper. And it's just 15 minutes, 20 minutes from the city of Jerusalem. So if you do that, if anybody does that, they lose their residency. They have another law, they call it the loyalty law. If they can prove that any Palestinian, he or she, their loyalty is not to the state of Israel, they can take or revoke their residency. Can you imagine an occupier? Does it happen anywhere in the world that there is a people who are under occupation, they should be loyal to their occupier? It's only Israel who does that. You know, with regard to revoking residency for political reason, till now, during the last few years, there have been 12 cases who they lost their residency because of their political activities. And because of the Center of Life, there is a number of 14,525 Palestinians, they lost their residency in East Jerusalem because their center of life was not East Jerusalem, because they were in either Ramallah, the other part of the West Bank, or Jordan, or wherever they go. One of the cases for housing and housing demolition, maybe some of you heard about Silwan. Silwan is a neighborhood in the south of the old city of Jerusalem. It's one of the areas that has been targeted by the settler movements. There is a neighborhood called Al-Bustan in Silwan. There are 130 families in this neighborhood, 88 buildings. Israel, in 2005, they declared that this area is a green area. Of course, in the green area, building is not allowed. Any building in the green area should be demolished. So they issue a demolition order against 88 buildings, 130 families who live in As-Silwan. You know why? They believe that King David was used to walk in this area. So they want to build a biblical park in this area. So this is one of the major cases for demolition. As the people say, what is important? That King David was walking in this area, or our children and women to be homeless? So this is a battle since 2005. Our lawyers in the Civic Coalition, we take the case and we try to defend the people. We try to stop this plan against the municipality, Israeli municipality of Jerusalem. And there is another case which I think a lot of you heard about, Sheikh Jarrah. It's one of the main examples for evictions. You know, in Sheikh Jarrah, there are 52 families who they have been living since 1956. Jordan provided the land, and the UNRWA built housing unit for families who were refugees from 1948. So they have been living there until 1972. Then Israeli settler group, they claim that they own the land. And since then, they have been going to the court trying to evict these Palestinians. There is a plan in the municipality to build a settlement of 250 housing units for the Israeli Jewish settlers. These two cases are one of the main or major examples for house demolitions and house eviction that Israel is really trying to take over or try to evict the people from their houses in this area.
His name is Zakaria Odeh, and we're presenting portions of a talk he gave in Chicago. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Zakaria Odeh is executive director of the Civic Coalition for Palestinian Rights in Jerusalem. In his presentation, Odeh also talked about judges in Israel putting children in East Jerusalem under house arrest.
It could be for 4 weeks, it could be 2 months, 3 months, it could reach like 8 and 9 months until the trial will take place. You know, what does that mean to be in a house arrest? The parents, they have to play the role of warden guard. Usually, the police take one of the parents, either the mother or the father or an adult in the house, and they have to sign a commitment that the person, the child, will not leave the house whatsoever. If the child gets sick, the father has to go to the security office or the police to get a permission for only 1 hour. That the father has to take the child to the doctor and bring him back within this 1 hour. The families have to expect the visit of the security or the police every day. Sometimes they visit the house twice a day to check that the child is in the house. You know, what does that create? It creates a lot of hatred by the children against their parents. Because in this situation, they start believing that the parents who are really imprisoning the children is not the security or the police. In many cases, the family, they say, we prefer that they are arrested and they are in the prison rather being in prison in the house under what's so-called house arrest. So this is one of really main tools. You know why they do that? Mainly because they are trying to break the psychology of this generation. You know, people, children under, like between the age 18, 14, 13, 16, 17, it really goes down to 12 years old, they can sentence for house arrest. So this is, they know that this is the future generation. You know, maybe more than 55% of the Palestinians are young. or children, even in the age of children, under 18. The other issue is education, which is related as well to children. You know, Israel, always the time since they occupied East Jerusalem, they always try to control the education system. I don't know if some of you are aware, since 1967, when they occupied East Jerusalem, they tried to impose the Israeli curriculum or textbook and education system. There was a big battle. Schools were in strike for 3 years. Between 67 until 71, there were no schools. Most schools were in strike because schools, students, parents, they refused to accept and to implement the Israeli education system. Until in the end, the Israelis, they accepted that they used the same education system which was used during the Jordanian before 67. Till the BA came, the Palestinian Authority, they developed a Palestinian curriculum where they start teaching the students, including East Jerusalem. That went on until 2011. In 2011, the Israeli municipality, Jerusalem municipality, and the Minister of Education, they decide that Palestinian schools in East Jerusalem, they can't use this curriculum. We have to provide you with a new textbook. You know what they did? They took out, they crossed anything related to the Palestinian history, Palestinian narrative, Palestinian struggle, anything about the Palestinian, the occupation, the policy of the occupation, and they have been trying to force the school to use this curriculum. Last year, they went further step, and they start imposing the curriculum that has been used within 1948, the green area, which called Israel. So last year, they start imposing the curriculum. You know, this curriculum, we did a study about it. You know, they talk about the war, the Nakba, or the war in 1948, the war of independence. They teach that Jerusalem is the capital of the Israeli state. They talk about the Israeli leadership, the Zionist leadership who led the Zionist movement before the establishment of the Israeli state, and after that, they never talk about the history of the Palestinian. So it is a kind of brainwashing for the people, for the students. And this issue has been one of the major battles in occupied East Jerusalem for the last few years. So education is very important for us because it is occupation of the mentality, occupation of the people, how they think. And this is very dangerous. Always I say, if they demolish a house, the house might be rebuilt. But if they destroy the people, how they think, this is very, very difficult to restore. It's very difficult to rehabilitate. And that's what they are trying to do. The last thing, just within this situation, Palestinians in East Jerusalem, or in Jerusalem in particular, and in the occupied territories, are facing a systematic, very well-planned ethnic cleansing policy, population forcible transfer. Israel, they made people in Gaza refugees by using tanks, aeroplanes, by shelling the Gaza for days and for weeks. But what they do in East Jerusalem or in Jerusalem, it is a silent war. Through these policies, they try to force the people to leave the city and to kick them outside of the city of East Jerusalem. So because of all this was going on, there are like 38 NGOs that has been closed since 2000 by the Israeli Ministry of Interior. You know, that any time they can say it is a threat for the security of the state of Israel, they can close any institution, any civil society organization. They can stop any activities. Like once we had a meeting to talk to people about how to deal, what are the Israeli laws, what are the Israeli legal systems, so how can you deal with it? So they prevented us, they closed the hotel, they gave him 24 hours that if he doesn't stop the activity, the whole hotel will be closed for 6 months. So they have been really suppressing, they have been trying to stop or prevent the freedom of expression of our people in Jerusalem in particular and the occupied territories as a whole. That's because of all of that. So because we believe the problem in Jerusalem is a political problem, it's not a humanitarian. And unfortunately, always like donors state, they try to deal with occupied East Jerusalem as a humanitarian issue rather than a political issue that it needs a political solution.
That was Zakaria Odeh, Executive Director of the Civic Coalition for Palestinian Rights in Jerusalem, speaking in Chicago last June. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain, and I want to thank Dale Lehman at WZRD for furnishing the audio of Odeh's talk, which was edited by yours truly. We turn now to another activist who works on issues relating to detention and torture, with a specific focus on Guantanamo Bay. Frida Berrigan helped found Witness Against Torture, a nonviolent direct action group working to shut down Guantanamo. She is the daughter of two prominent peace activists, the late Philip Berrigan and Elizabeth McAllister. She's also the author of It Runs in the Family, on being raised by radicals and growing into rebellious motherhood. When Frida Berrigan spoke last October in Syracuse, she began by reading a passage from the writings of her father, Philip Berrigan, who was frequently imprisoned for his anti-war activism. You'll then hear her read from her book, and when she says her dad was in the hole, she means in solitary confinement.
I see little difference between the world inside the prison gates and the world outside. A million prison walls can't protect us, because the real dangers, militarism, greed, economic inequality, fascism, police brutality, lie outside, not inside prison walls. And I think that that's a quote that really could only have been distilled and sort of concretized inside prison. And it is this odd realization of a daughter about a father who was perhaps fully alive and fully sort of connected to other people and fully himself when he was away from us, when he was away from his immediate family and was behind bars. And I thought a lot about how we as a family maintained a tight familial relationship, how we wrote and visited and connected with one another while he was in prison and while my mother was in prison. But this this piece of it that he was kind of happiest or most fully realized in prison is uncomfortable and a little sad to me, and also something I admire there. And it's a good time to talk about prisons, right? It's a good time to reflect on prisons, right? There are 2.4 million of us, 2.4 million Americans in prison right now. So that made me want to turn to some of the things that my dad had written while in prison and his reflections on being a prisoner, on being this, identifying himself as a person of phenomenal privilege, right? Well-educated, physically strong, white Catholic American, a priest, a Roman Catholic priest, this person of privilege trying to take some of that off or peel some of those layers off, and not being able to fully do that, but being most able to be in touch with other human beings in prison. One of the issues that has really preoccupied me over the last number of years has been Guantanamo, right? And the internment of Muslim and Arab men at Guantanamo. And I helped to start an organization called Witness Against Torture, which Ed and others have really supported and been a part of. We went to Cuba in 2005 and again in 2015, trying to get to the prison. And at some point I was asked sort of why this issue amongst like all issues that are kind of out there and everything that I could be spending my time doing, why is this the thing? And it comes back to my experience of having a father in prison. So with your indulgence, I'll sort of finish by reading just a little bit of this. There are so many issues, so many injustices, so many transgressions that tug at the heartstrings and the conscience, and only so much time, only so much energy. And I'm haunted by the family shattered by indefinite detention. I'm undone by the fact that they suffer for our security. And I do what I can because I cannot sit idly by while children are kept from their fathers. Even before I really understood time, I always knew that my mom and dad would come home from jail. It was not forever. It was not endless. 6 months, 18 months, 2 years, even the longest sentence had a come home date. And there was always someone in the community who could figure out what an 18-month federal sentence actually meant. Time off for good behavior, the newest sentencing guidelines that made every third Friday count for 2.25 days, whatever. There was always someone who could say, look at it this way, 18 months sounds like a really long time, but your dad will be home before next Easter. And they were right. He was always coming home, and so was mom. But Ferris and Johina and Michael's father has not come home. Shakir Amer is originally from Saudi Arabia, but he's lived in the United Kingdom since 1966, where he's a legal resident married to a British citizen. Shakir and his family were in Afghanistan in 2001 doing charity work when he was seized by Afghan bounty hunters and turned over to U.S. forces. He recalled his relief at ending up in American hands after being held and mistreated by various Afghan groups. But that relief was short-lived. He was brought to Guantanamo in February of 2002 and tortured repeatedly, singled out as a ringleader, and subjected to gross abuses. Shakir Amer has been cleared for release since June of 2007, and the Bush and Obama administrations agree that he's not a terrorist, that he poses no threat to the United States or its interests, and yet he continues to languish at the prison. And he was finally released in November of 2015 after just extraordinary organizing by British citizens on his behalf. When I first started learning about Guantanamo, one of the things that really struck me was how letters in and out of the prison were read and censored. Lakhdar Boumahinedine, an Algerian who spent more than 7 years at Guantanamo, wrote an op-ed in 2012 in the New York Times, and he wrote, "During that time, my daughters grew up without me. They were toddlers when I was imprisoned and were never allowed to visit or speak to me on the phone. Most of their letters were returned as undeliverable, and the few that I received were so thoroughly and thoughtlessly censored that their messages of love and support were lost. I still have so many letters from my dad, and when I miss him, all I need to do is open up a green box that sits on my desk and hold a small piece of him in my hand. Slips of yellow legal pad, usually just a quarter sheet, just about this big, his handwriting neat and legible with a spidery slant, his voice still so alive. I know that envelopes in and out of jails and prisons in the US are subjected to search and could be read, but his letters were never altered. When I stay up too late working on a press release, when the last thing I want to do is brainstorm ideas for the next action, when I'm hungry and delirious on day 2 of a 10 or 12 day fast, when I spend the night on a hard and grubby floor of a police holding cell, when the handcuffs are too tight, when the orange jumpsuit is too unflattering or too hot or too cold or too stinky from the last person who wore it, when the last thing I want to do is go to another demonstration to close Guantanamo, I think about those 10 days our family spent working to get my dad out of the hole. I think about how precious that first letter after the long silence was. I think about how happy I was to hear his voice on the phone. And I think about how, even when he was incommunicado, he was always coming home. And I want that for Ferris and Johina and all the parents and children at Guantanamo."
That's the activist and writer Frida Berrigan speaking at Art Rage Gallery in Syracuse, New York. Here's another excerpt from her talk.
"I began to get an inkling of the cost of these actions after our father died, sort of accompanying my mom as my brother and sister got arrested, knowing that my sister was accompanying her as I was getting arrested, and sort of seeing her struggle with us getting arrested, and it being almost comical to me at the time, and this was before I was married or had children, but it was hilarious to me that she was worried about us. I mean, it was also very sweet, but there was something kind of funny about it, right? This is a woman who, at the White House one time, you know, the police, grabbed her arm and, you know, kind of took the banner out of her hand, and she put it in her mouth. And as the cops, handcuffed her, right? And she held onto it with her mouth until they pulled it out, you know? And this is a fierce woman, right? And my sister did this action. My sister's kind of hardcore, and she climbed the Transamerica building in Los Angeles at this banner drop action, maybe like 8 years ago. And she's hanging off the side of this building, you know, getting kind of like buffeted by the wind, and this enormous building against Ford's use of fossil fuels. And my mom, I happened to be in Baltimore, I was living in New York at the time, and my mom is calling the organizer, a young woman named Hillary, as I recall. Hello, Hillary. How's everything going out there? Like on the hour, you know, for these updates. And Kate finally, gets, down, safely arrested, processed, flies back to Baltimore, all in the course of like a day and a half. She gets off the plane and my mom says, well, Hillary must have been so busy with everybody's parents, right? Because they're all sort of young, right out of college kind of people, dealing with everybody's parents as she's, dealing with press and police and all of this different stuff. And mom said, oh, no, mom, nobody else's mom was calling Hillary, just you. And mom was like, oh, did they not know? And Kate was like, right, they did not know that their kids were hanging from the side of a building. And I said, Mom, maybe in the future you don't want to know either. And she said, no, I must know. So it's a funny story, but it's the beginning of me being like, oh, right, like this was hard for us as kids, right? But we kind of as kids were sort of told to, like, our part of the work is to kind of go with this. And then to see that kind of from a different angle as a young adult, as my mom, struggles to do this now alone, right? Like without my dad is sort of this like, it's gonna be okay, And then honestly, since I've had children, I've been arrested like once, right? And I went to Cuba in the fall and, or Thanksgiving of last year, when I was gone for almost 2 weeks and we fasted and we put ourselves in a position where we could have been apprehended by the Cuban police or Cuban government. But we weren't, and then came back, and there was no consequence on the American side because there's been, because of the warming of relations between our two countries. But I think I have a really good sense of how hard, it's hard to get arrested, but it's a lot harder to be the people who are sort of holding it together on the other end. Like if my conscience sort of demanded that of me, my husband would, he'd kind of be all for it. He was really pushing me to go to Cuba and do this. He also had this ulterior motive, which was weaning our year and a half-year-old daughter at the time. He's like, go, and I'll wean her, and she'll come back, and she'll never want to nurse again. And I was like, okay, all right, that sounds good. But I think, I think going to jail was easier for my father than, what we did, for the abolition of nuclear weapons, right, that he had it easier, and I think he knew that too, that my mom had the harder job when she was home with us, that the community that took care of us had the harder job, and that we, as 3-year-olds and 5-year-olds and 11-year-olds and 17-year-olds, that we had the harder job, and that his conscience demanded a lot of us. And he was confident that, we could do that, and we could, and that toughness is, in my siblings and I, as a result of that. But he never asked us, neither of our parents ever asked us. And I think that's because they would have done it anyway. they would have done it anyway. And I do a lot of things that my kids don't want me to do, but I can't imagine that, right? I can't imagine that. And yet, the times call for all sorts of things from us, right? And so, I guess one of the things that I discovered in Witness Against Torture, and through like a funny kind of waking dream and a conversation that I had with my dad a number of years after he was dead, and maybe the easiest way is to just tell this story. I'm walking to the Supreme Court, and I'm by myself, and I'm fasting, and I'm carrying like a whole bunch of signs and like a bag full of jumpsuits, and I'm carrying a sound system on this side. So I've kind of got like all this stuff, and I'm late, and I'm, you know, kind of rushing, and my dad says to me, "This is too busy. You got too much going on here. There are too many moving pieces. You got to keep it simple, Frida." And I said, "Dad, you know, not everybody can just go up the steps of the Pentagon with a baby bottle full of blood and throw blood on the Pentagon, right? Like, not everybody can do that." Kind of declaiming the entire way, you know, articulately. Like, we can't all do that. That's simple, but we can't all do that. And he says, "Okay, yeah, I hear that." And I said, "These are all pieces. These are all these moving pieces mean that a lot of people can participate in this action. And that there's a role for everybody, including the people who can't talk, you know, and kind of extemporaneously just sort of mouth off, and including the people who can't get arrested, including, you know, the people who are shy, who are just learning about these issues. I have on my person all the pieces that can invite a lot of people to participate in this action." And he said, "Oh, okay, well, good luck then. And hurry up, because they're waiting for you." That was, and then I just like burst into tears, right? And like started running. But that has been the thing that I really have wanted to do and have occasionally succeeded at is through War Resisters League, through Witness Against Torture, through sort of other efforts that I've been a part of, really wanting to make room for a lot of people to participate and be a part of things, and to kind of dismantle a little bit the sort of the trope of the fearless leader, right? Which, you know, my dad didn't want to be like the fearless leader, but he was really well suited to it, and, you know, he was a former priest and a big guy and somebody who a lot of people look to, and I saw him kind of struggle with that a lot, and then kind of, you know, default to it because it's easy.
Frida Berrigan is her name. She co-founded the group Witness Against Torture, and her book is It Runs in the Family, on being raised by radicals and growing into rebellious motherhood. She spoke in Syracuse last October. Thanks to Wilton Vaught of Other Voices, Other Choices for providing the audio of Berrigan's talk. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.